Okay, Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning Bible study, Chag Pesach Sameach. Happy Passover, joyous Passover to everyone. I wanted to start off the morning by greeting you. This is one of the festivals mentioned in Leviticus chapter 23. It is also mentioned in Deuteronomy 16 and several other places, but we are in the season. We're in the season of Passover, and I want to talk to you a little bit today about Passover, specifically about a theme. I'm going to draw out of the many, many themes that are possible. I'm going to talk to you about one in particular that I think is very important, but it's often overlooked. In fact, I would say that it is the main reason for the Passover. And I was looking back over our friend Baruch. John shares the past however many years of teachings that I've given and all the notes on those. And I saw it after I prepared my class last night. And I said, I don't think I've really talked specifically about this in all the years that I've been teaching publicly. So I'm excited about it. I've been excited about it. I stayed up late and got up early, and I've been waiting on you to show up, and now you're finally here. So we'll be talking about this. You'll notice, you won't notice that I'm wearing sandals, but those of you who know me know that there are very few times that I'm not these days. Since I left my former employer in July of 2016, I rarely wear socks and shoes, but I'm ready. At least according to the English Bible, I'm ready to eat a meal in haste. I've got, you know, my sandals, I've got a staff, I've got a Haggadah, which is the book that we use to tell the story. I've also got some matzah here, but I'm not going to do a Passover Seder for you. And there are many reasons I will not get into at this particular point. I think a lot of people are holding a Seder. Some had a Seder last night. Some will hold it tonight. Some, who knows? I mean, there are a lot of different calendars and debates, and just pick one, you know, if you choose to participate. For me, personally and privately, I love the Festival of Unleavened Bread. I love the taste of unleavened bread, actually, and I like bitter herbs, so I'm ready. I'm ready for the season, but I'm especially ready to talk to you about the topic that I have for you today. Before I do that, I want to take just a few moments to address some of the issues, some of the arguments or reasons that people need to take a deep breath and, as we can say in our culture today, chill out. There are a lot of people who argue over days and months and who's got the right calendar and did you do your Seder the right way and all that. So I wanted to take just one moment or a few minutes to start off and tell you the reason that I can say respectfully for everyone to take a deep breath and chill out is that none of you, me included, are doing the Passover as written. Not a one. Not you, not you, not you, not you, not you, not you, none of you, none of, I'm not either. So let's all take a deep breath. And so I want to take just a few minutes and go through a couple of texts to start off again by saying, Happy Passover, everyone, even you who are screwed up in the way that you're doing it, it's okay. All right? Can you say that? That's what, you know what I mean? All right. So some would argue various aspects of this festival. In fact, I would say many do. All you have to do is join Facebook and you'll see the debates. Usually these are associated with someone suggesting that there is a right way, and it's usually the way they do it, right? I mean, that's typically. Like, I don't say, look, I don't do Passover right, but Sherry does. So if you follow Sherry, you see. All right. So, but I want to suggest that if we take a close look at the text. So this is sort of a warm-up for my class, if you will. If we take a close look at some of the texts that I'm going to cover in this little introduction piece, you'll see that none of us are keeping Passover as written. Rather, in all cases, and I say all, A-L-L, what you're doing in essence is you are participating in a memorial, memorial of a watershed event in human history. So, given that, enjoy. Now, I would further propose and suggest, and then back it up with Scripture, that it's probably okay, even in the eyes of Jehovah, if you're not doing it exactly right. Okay? Now, that's a little bit tougher challenge, right? It's one thing for me to say relax, and you're probably going to be okay, because you may or may not believe me. But if I say, let me show you in the text where you're probably okay with God, then that might make you feel a little bit better. Because I have some emails that have come in that have asked me some specific questions, like, can I do the Passover if, you know, and various things. I'll get into answering those this week. It's been a long week. Now, the first thing I'd like to do is make an observation. It's just an observation. And I'm entitled to do that, right? We all know that that first Passover described in the Torah, we know how that one went. We know how that one went. And just as a point, I can tell you that it wasn't a four-hour meal with different cups of wine and, you know, people reclining on cushions. And so that image that a lot of people have is not the way that that meal looked when the children of Israel departed from Egypt. About the only thing that's pretty close is the fact that the moon was full. And then you didn't have anything to do with setting the moon in the sky. So just take that point for what it is. Now, while there are texts which mention various aspects of the festival of Passover throughout the Torah and the Tanakh, throughout the Law of Moses and the Hebrew Bible, the only mention of Passover being done when the children of Israel are in the wilderness, one time. So I want you to think about that. It's just an observation that 40 years in the wilderness, now I'm not saying that the Torah should have recorded every one of the 40 Passovers that took place in the wilderness, but it is an interesting observation that the only other mention of a Passover being conducted or a Passover service being done. By the way, in Hebrew, most of the time in English, you're going to read, keep the Passover. In Hebrew, I can't think of an exception where the word is not literally do the Pesach, do it, right? But while there are aspects of the Passover and themes that are associated with this redemption, there's only one mention of the Passover being kept, and that is in the book of Numbers. In the book of Numbers, in Numbers chapter 9. Numbers chapter 9 tells us specifically that the children of Israel in the first month, in the second year after their coming out of Egypt, they kept the Passover. Now, what it also gets into is that there were people mentioned in the book of Numbers chapter 9 who were unable to keep the Passover because they were ritually impure. A lot of people say unclean, but that gives the wrong idea. So I'll use a more accurate description and call it ritually impure, whether they have come in contact with a dead body or whatever it is, it makes them ritually impure. So they can't keep the Passover, but they want to keep the Passover. So Moses, they go to Moses. Moses goes to God. God tells him, and I'm paraphrasing, that's a good point. So what do we do? So he sets up in Numbers chapter 9 a second Passover, which will be conducted on the 14th day of the second month. So if you're not ready, if you're ritually impure in the first month on the 14th day. You're going to move then to do it in the second month on the first day. All right. So that's the only mention, other than the initial Exodus, the initial Pesach, of a Passover being done in the wilderness. Now, the next time we meet with the Passover, it's in the book of Joshua, in Joshua chapter 5. The children of Israel are preparing to enter into the land. They cross over into the plains of Jericho, and they are at a place called, that's later called, Gilgal. And the children of Israel there, in fact, go with me to Joshua chapter 5. Let me just touch on a couple of points here, because this is important. I want people to relax a little bit about Passover. And some of you are thinking that you shouldn't be able to relax. All right, so in Joshua chapter 5, beginning in verse 2, and I'm just going to tell you the story. Jehovah tells Joshua, get you some flint knives, because we need to circumcise these people. Right? Now, here's the thing. We read very clearly in verse 4. Let me just pick up in verse 4. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died on the way in the wilderness after they had come up out of Egypt. Now, verse 5, though all the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people that were born in the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised. So in other words, they go about for 40 years in the wilderness, not a single circumcision takes place. Those that started out were circumcised, but when they had children, they didn't circumcise them for 40 years. Now you can think of a lot of reasons, but the bottom line is they didn't. And so all that generation, the men of war age, die off because of their rebellion and so forth, and bringing the bad report. You remember the story about the tourist, often called spies. They're really tourists. It says they toured the land, right? In Hebrew, tour. So these, this generation dies off, and so God is telling Joshua, we have to get them ready. And so they did circumcise them, and in verse 10 of chapter 5 in Joshua, it says, while the people of Israel were encamped in Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at evening in the plains of Jericho. Now, we're in Joshua, all right? We're talking about the conquest of Canaan. Now, the next time that it's mentioned is in 2 Chronicles chapter 30. Now, as you're turning there, especially if you're in a Hebrew Bible, there's a good bit of space between these two. Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, according to the way that the Hebrew Bible is arranged, 2 Chronicles is the closing book of the Hebrew Bible, of the Tanakh. So it tells us that there is a long period of time where it's not mentioned. Now, this doesn't mean, I'm not suggesting that they didn't keep Passover. I'm going to get real close to that, though, in just a few minutes, because I'm going to let Scripture tell you what I mean. But it does say that it's not this huge focus, right? This is my point. In 2 Chronicles 30, what we have here is a revival of sorts. Now, after council, it was determined they wanted to do a Passover. The king wants to do a Passover. The advisors want to do a Passover. But they determine in 2 Chronicles 30 that they're not ready. All right? They're not ready to keep it in the first month on the 14th day. And we're going to talk about why. So, according to chapter 9 of the book of Numbers, which we just read, we recognize they know that there is an opportunity to do a second Passover. All right, 1 month later. Now, it's determined that they feel like they can get ready for this one. Now, I want you to look in 2 Chronicles 30, I want to read verse 3. For they could not keep it in its time because the priest had not sanctified themselves in sufficient number, nor had the people assembled in Jerusalem. Now, this is one of the points that I want to make. People who want to say, well, I do the Passover rite and they're in St. Francisville. All right. Well, part of the thing is it's one of the pilgrimage festivals. So you're supposed to be doing it in Jerusalem, right? Doing the Passover in Jerusalem. So all of you in Boise, Idaho, and Charlotte, North Carolina, and Ottawa, Canada, and, you know, South Africa, and wherever, you're not doing it according as it is written. So this is one of the take a deep breath moments. Now, look down at verse 5. Verse 5 says, so they decreed to make a proclamation throughout all Israel from Beersheba to Dan that the people should come and keep the Passover to Jehovah, the God of Israel, at Jerusalem, for they had not kept it in great numbers as prescribed. All right. Now, the first thing I want to focus on is as prescribed. Right? So it's saying that there is a way to do the Passover, and they're not doing it accordingly as it was prescribed. Now, is that a major problem? Right? I mean, religious people love to know that they're right and sometimes rejoice in the fact that others aren't right. Well, this is why I started the way I started. I want you to look with me to chapter 30, 2 Chronicles, beginning in verse 17. For there were many in the assembly who had not sanctified themselves. There's that phrase again. Therefore, the Levites had to kill the Passover lamb for everyone who was not clean, ritually pure, to make it holy to Jehovah. For a multitude of the people, many of them from Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar, and Zebulun, had not cleansed themselves, yet they ate the Passover otherwise than as prescribed. Uh-oh. For Hezekiah had prayed for them, saying, the good Jehovah pardon everyone who sets his heart to seek God, Jehovah, the God of his fathers, even though not according to the sanctuary's rules of cleanness. Now, I love this verse. This is one of the reasons that Hezekiah goes down in history as a man of righteousness, because look what he does. Rather than get on Facebook and criticize the way others are doing it, he recognizes that some of the people aren't keeping it as prescribed now. And so he prays. And he says, the good Jehovah, forgive these people. Pardon everyone who sets his heart to seek God. This is my prayer this Passover season, that the good Jehovah will pardon every one of us who were trying to seek out God. See, that's the important thing. Now, God answers this. Are you ready? Let's take our deep breath. Now look at verse 20. And Jehovah heard Hezekiah and healed the people. Now, I would look at this as an acceptance of this prayer. To me, it says that God knows that many of his people haven't sanctified themselves. They may think they're sanctified, but they're not pure as it is prescribed. It takes a Hezekiah, and that's what we need in this generation, more Hezekiahs who at least acknowledge that people are seeking God and they're trying. They're trying to make amends. They're trying to do what's right according to Scripture. Now, about 75 years later, give or take a few, 75 years, another king would arise who also is righteous. And some of you know this king. His name is Josiah. Now, go with me to 2 Chronicles chapter 35. This is where this story exists. Now, I'm going to encourage you to read the entire chapters, but I've got so much to cover today that I'm not going to. But in 2 Chronicles chapter 35, if you look at verse 1, just read that. Josiah kept a Passover to Jehovah in Jerusalem, and they killed the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. And it goes through all the details of that Passover. Now look at verse 17. And the people of Israel who were present kept the Passover at that time and the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days. No Passover like it had been kept in Israel, are you ready? Since the days of Samuel, the prophet. None of the kings of Israel had kept such a Passover as was kept by Josiah, and the priests and the Levites and all Judah and Israel who were present and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Now listen to me. Not since the days of Samuel the prophet. Now look, here's what a lot of people think. When they sit down at their Passover Seder, and I'm not knocking this because I do this too, and you present the story as if this has been an unbroken chain since the days of Adam, that everybody, or at least since Moses, I was using that as an exaggeration point, but if you look at it and you go, since Moses brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, they sat down at their little, had their little Seder plate with the little divisions and they put their egg and their parsley and their chesed and their shank bone, and they told the story. And this has been going on every year uninterrupted for more than 3,300 years. Not true. Not true at all. This is roughly, he's saying here that this is roughly 350 years. Did you catch that? Such a Passover, no Passover like it had been kept in Israel since the days of Samuel. Now, I know people can argue about chronology, but give it to me here that I'm just estimating that we're talking about more than 300 years, 350 probably. Now, go with me to 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 23. 2 Kings 23, this isn't my class, by the way, verse 21, 2 Kings 23, 21. And the king commanded all the people, keep the Passover, this is about Josiah, by the way, to Jehovah your God, as it is written in the book of the covenant. For no such Passover, if I had a red and blue pencil, I'd underline this verse. For no such Passover had been kept since the days of the judges who judged Israel, or during all the days of the kings of Israel, or of the kings of Judah. But in the 18th year of Josiah, that means for 17 years of Josiah's reign, they didn't even keep it like this. But in the 18th year of King Josiah, this Passover was kept to Jehovah in Jerusalem. Now, that's a long time. This is not a festival that's been kept without interruption for 3,400, 3,300 years. It's rarely been kept as prescribed for a lot of reasons. The people aren't in Jerusalem. The people hadn't sanctified themselves. They've been in contact with the dead. They've been on a journey, whatever the case. Now look, by the way, speaking of Josiah, look at verse 25. Before him, there was no king like him who turned to Jehovah with all his heart, with all his soul, with all his might, according to all the Torah of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. Man, that's something. Talking about Josiah. You'll recognize that phrase. It's the only place, you know, in Deuteronomy 6, where it talks about with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your very, Josiah is the only one who does this, basically. And then notice the phrase, not another rose like him. It reminds me of this idea of the prophet in Deuteronomy 18. But that's a whole other issue. Now, one other time in the Tanakh, keeping the Passover is mentioned. I'm not going to talk about that other than to say in Ezra chapter 6, there is a recording of a Passover kept by the returning exiles when they came back from Babylon. Now, a major part of Passover today centers around telling the story of the redemption of Israel from Egypt, what is commonly known or referred to as the Exodus. The Exodus. You've seen the movie, right? Now, without doubt, the Exodus is the greatest event in human history. Scholars debate, they debate all aspects of it. The details of the Exodus story are so fantastic that some people doubt the veracity of any of it. And so recently, and I have this book called The Exodus by Richard Elliot Friedman, and he gets into this. Now, he's approaching it from an academic standpoint. You've heard me talk about minimalist and maximalist, those who say nothing happened, that it's all phony, all the way to some who say every bit of it happened literally word for word, and some of you are on all aspects of that plane. It's not my job to get you to move on that. That's up to you. But I will say this. I will say that in Richard Friedman's book, I liked it. Didn't agree with everything in it because I would probably be more on that maximalist plane than he is. But at the same time, he gave me much to think about, much to think about. And he describes that when he first fell in love with the story, he was a 10-year-old boy, and he was waiting in line to see the movie, what's the famous Exodus movie, The Ten Commandments? And he says he remembers being seated in the theater and watching Charlton Heston in the water part, and he said he fell in love with the story. You know, you think about the impact of these stories on children. And now he's one of the greatest scholars, I say greatest, most respected scholars of the Hebrew Bible. You may not agree with his conclusions, but he fell in love with it as a child. Now, in his book, The Exodus, it says the following. The Exodus is the story of the birth of a nation and the birth of some cornerstone ideas. Practically everything that follows the Exodus in the Bible flows from it. In other words, it begins here. It begins here in the story of the Exodus. It is a reference point. People look back on it. And I concur, and therefore today, I want to focus on one single element of the greatest story ever told. I'm calling my class today, The Exodus and the Making of God's Name. The Exodus and the Making of God's Name. Now, I propose to you all that this, the making of a name for God, is the main point of the story of the Exodus. It applies universally, even to the Egyptians at the time, as well as every people of all time and for all time. In other words, this concept, this element of the Exodus, is so essential to get that it goes beyond the borders of Israel, the people, the religion. It goes into all the nations of the world, all people, all time, this point about making a name for God. Go with me to the book of Exodus, to the book of Exodus chapter 9. And I'm going to be rapid fire. I'm going through so much today because I'm cramming 4 hours into an hour and 15 minutes. Exodus chapter 9, go with me to verse 15. This is where Jehovah is basically talking to Moses and telling him what to tell Pharaoh on his behalf. In fact, let me start in verse 13. Then Jehovah said to Moses, "Rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus says Jehovah, the God of the Hebrews, Shalakatami, send forth my people.'" A lot of people translate that, "let my people go." I like, "send forth my people." It's not like, I don't know, maybe it is adjusive. I'll look at it in the Hebrew, but it's almost more of a "let them go," you know, like "send them out, that they may serve me." Let me read it a little bit differently. "Let my people go that they may serve me." You see, it's not the verb "serve." See, they're already serving. They're already servants. They're slaves. That's what the Hebrew word means. The point is not the fact that he wants them to be servants. He wants them to be his servants, Jehovah's servants. So what he's basically telling Pharaoh is, "Let your slaves go. I'm taking them to be my slaves." A lot of people get nervous when you call the Israelite people slaves. Well, that's because they don't read their Bible. The idea is that they're going to serve Jehovah. That's what he's telling him. Now, look, verse 14, this is what he tells him to tell Pharaoh. Can you imagine? "For this time, I'll send all my plagues upon your heart and upon your servants and your people, that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth." 15, "For by now I could have put forth my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, and you would have been cut off from the earth. But," here we go, "but for this purpose I've let you live, to show you my power," get this, "so that my name may be declared throughout all the earth." That's the point. That's the main point. That is what this is about. The only reason that he didn't just quickly cut off Pharaoh and Egypt and eliminate the problem was so his name would be proclaimed in all the earth. Now, in Hebrew, the word "proclaimed" is from a root word, saper. You may know the word a sofer, or it's the idea of counting, to count, to relate. When we give a story, we're giving an account of something. We're talking, we're numbering the details of it. So he basically says that his name would be recounted throughout all the earth because of this event. He tells Pharaoh, "Look, the only reason I didn't squash you is so that my name would be proclaimed to the ends of the earth." Now, look with me a similar verse, Psalm 22. This is a psalm of David, who, by the way, didn't keep the Passover, at least not like Josiah. Think about that. Let that sink in for a minute. Psalm 22, let me just read verse 22 in the English, 23 in the Hebrew. "I will tell of your name to my brethren in the midst of the congregation. I will praise thee." Where it says, "I will tell of thy name," it's "I will recount." It's this same root word that's used in Exodus chapter 9. Now, while we're doing a Psalm of David, let's just look at Psalm 8, please. Psalm 8. Now, let's see. If you look at verse 1 in the English, verse 2 in the Hebrew, O Jehovah, our Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. See this idea? It's the idea of making God's name known in all the earth. Look down at verse 10, verse 9 in English. O Jehovah, our Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. This was the goal of the Exodus. The goal of the Exodus is to make a name for God. Stick with me. Go with me to 2 Samuel, 2 Samuel chapter 7. And you'll recall in this story, David, man, I love the Bible. David is going to build God a house, and Nathan tells him, yeah, do whatever's in your heart. And then God tells Nathan, that's not what I need. I don't need a house. I'm going to build David a house. So he sends him back to David. He tells David, you're not building me a house. I'm going to build you a house, right? Because what is this that your hands have made? Isaiah 66. But anyway, he says this. Look down. I'm going to read to you what David said after being told by Jehovah what Jehovah is going to do for David. Look down at verse 18, chapter 7. Then David, King David, 2 Samuel 7, 18. King David went in and sat before Jehovah and said, who am I, O Adonai Jehovah, and what is my house that you have brought me thus far? And yet this was a small thing in your eyes, O Adonai Jehovah. You have spoken also of your servant's house for a great while to come and have shown me future generations. O Adonai Jehovah, what more can David say to thee? For you know your servant, O Adonai Jehovah, because of your promise. And according to your own heart, you have wrought all this greatness to make your servant know it. Therefore, thou art great, O Jehovah, for there is none like thee, and there is no God beside thee, according to all that we have heard with our ears. What other nation on earth is like your people Israel, whom God went to redeem to be his people, making himself a name and doing for them great and terrible things by driving out before his people a nation and its gods? He went to redeem a people and in the process made himself a name. I wonder if it's fair to say it the other way. He went to make himself a name and in the process redeemed a people. How many times in Scripture, I'm thinking of Ezekiel 20 and other places, where it's he acts on behalf of his great name, that it might not be profaned. How many people today profane God's name, not in their words, but in their actions? Let me tell you, there is no other name under heaven than the name that we're talking about right here. Go with me to Isaiah 63. Isaiah chapter 63. In Isaiah chapter 63, go with me to verse 11. Then he remembered the days of old of Moses, his servant. Where is he who brought up out of the sea the shepherds of his flock? Where is he who put in the midst of them his Holy Spirit, who caused his glorious arm to go at the right hand of Moses, who divided the waters before them? Why? To make for himself an everlasting name, who led them through the depths like a horse in the desert. They did not stumble. Like cattle, they go down into the valley. The Spirit of Jehovah gave them rest. So you did lead your people to make for yourself a glorious name. You see this? Everything, the water splitting and being congealed, and you could see the fish swim through, and all of the miracles that are told. You know, some say, well, I don't believe those miracles happen. Well, that's pretty boring. Nothing? You know, it's like in Friedman's book. He's obviously on the minimalist side, but he said, you have to come to the conclusion where you, he said, I want you to ask yourself, did something happen or did nothing happen? Right? Some scholars and some pessimists out there say nothing happened. It's all just story. It's all made up. Some say everything happened. So I'm asking you today, did something happen or did nothing happen? I say something happened. And I'm saying specifically that something happened for a singular purpose, and that was to make Jehovah's name known throughout all the earth. And in the process, a people got redeemed. Now, that's not all. Go to Jeremiah 32. Jeremiah 32. In Jeremiah 32, I want you to look at verse 17. Adonai Jehovah, it is you who has made the heavens and the earth by your great power and by your outstretched arm. Now, by the way, this same phrase is used to describe the Exodus. The same outstretched arm that created the heavens did this other. Nothing is too hard for you. Verse 18, who shows steadfast love to thousands, but does requite the guilt of fathers to their children after them. O great and mighty God, whose name is Jehovah of hosts, great in counsel and might, indeed, whose eyes are open to all the ways of men, rewarding every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings, who has shown signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, and to this day in Israel, and, please understand this, among all mankind, and has made you a name as it is this day. Thou did bring your people Israel out of the land of Egypt with signs and wonders, with a strong hand, an outstretched arm, and with great terror. And you gave them this land, which you did swear to their fathers to give them, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they entered and took possession of it. You get the feel of these texts? All of these miraculous events lead up to God making a name for himself with the power of his arm and his outstretched strength and fury poured out. You can read Ezekiel 20 on your own. This is another powerful, powerful chapter. Now go with me to the book of Daniel. 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 Chapter 9. I just want to read one verse here. The whole prayer is very good. Daniel 9:15. And now, O Lord, our God, who did bring your people out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand and has made you a name as it is this day. We've sinned. So it's a confessional prayer. It's a prayer of repentance. Beautiful prayer. In fact, we ought to be reading this and meditating on it. We ought to be praying like this in our own prayer life. But notice, you've made you a name through this act of the Exodus, even to this day. Right? This is the thing he's known for. Now, one final, go with me to the book of Nehemiah, chapter 9. Nehemiah. As we say in the South, Nehemiah. Go to Nehemiah chapter 9. And this is Ezra speaking, by the way, just to give you the context. Verse 9, Nehemiah 9:9. And you did see the affliction of our fathers in Egypt and hear their cry at the Red Sea and did perform signs and wonders against Pharaoh and all his servants, and all the people of his land, for thou knewest that they acted insolently against our fathers, and you did get thee a name as it is to this day. And you did divide the sea before them, so that they went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and you didst cast their pursuers into the depths as a stone into the mighty waters. God, therefore, through the events of the Exodus, made a name for himself as it is this day. Go back with me to the book of Shemot, to the book of Exodus, chapter 3. This is where it all begins. You can say it actually begins in Genesis 1. But I'm going to suggest to you that when we're talking about the Exodus, I want to take you to the story in Exodus 3. We have a lot of background, biblical stories that lead up to this point. The children of Israel are in Egypt. Moses has already fled. Remember the story. I'm not going to go into all that detail. You have to go to a real long Passover Seder to get the whole story. But here's the deal. We're going to begin here in Exodus 3. It's called the story of the bush. You recall the story. And I want you to understand that this is the call of Moses. So go with me to chapter 3, verse 7. Then Jehovah said, I've seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt. Now remember what I just read to you in Daniel or in Nehemiah chapter 9. Said he saw that affliction. See, this is what spurs God to action, the cries of his people. Now look, verse 7. Jehovah said, I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I've seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. Now, but Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you. In other words, he doesn't answer his question about who am I? Because he says, who am I that I should do this? Here's what God's answer is. I'll be with you. Doesn't matter who you are, right? It doesn't matter who we are. God said, I'll be with you. And this shall be the sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought forth the people of Israel, you shall serve God upon this mountain. Now, where is he at? He's at Horeb. All right. Now, look, now he's got a great question for God. He says, OK, let me get this straight. You're going to send me to the king of Egypt. And I'm going to tell him that the God of the people of Israel is going to and they're going to say, what's his name? So Moses doesn't know God. Right. Now, look at this. Then Moses, verse 13, said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Now, I'm proposing to you that one of the single most important elements of the story of the Exodus is associated with God's name. And Moses brings up this great question. Right? Look at this. God said to Moses, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. And translated, some say, I am who I am. I will be what I will be. Google it. You'll see 10,000. I'm not going so much into the Hebrew today because I'm working on something else. God said, and he said, say this to the people of Israel, Ehyeh, I will be, has sent me to you. All right, look at verse 15. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, Jehovah, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. This is my name forever. Go with me to Exodus 6. Again, I've got a lot of verses to go through, but I want you at the end of this, you'll have a very clear picture of the main point. Exodus 6, 2, and God said to Moses, I am Jehovah. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as El Shaddai. But by my name Jehovah, I did not make myself known to them. Now, he's making a name that is particular to the covenant that has to do with the Exodus from Egypt. Remember, the class is the Exodus and the making of God's name. Now, there are a lot of things we could say about this particular text. There's some anachronistic, you see Jehovah throughout, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, throughout the text up to this point. But he says, at least here, he says very clearly that by my name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, I was not known to them. Now, I want to read to you some first-person examples where Jehovah associates his own name, the divine name, with the Exodus from Egypt. And I'm going to roll through these, but you got to stay with me. Exodus chapter 20. You'll recall this is the 10 words, also called the 10 commandments. All right. I am, Exodus 22, I am Jehovah your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Notice, I am Jehovah. I'm the one that brought you out of Egypt. Go to Leviticus, Leviticus chapter 11, verse 45. Leviticus 11, 45. For I am Jehovah who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. So not only is the name associated with the redemption from Egypt, but he also ties it to a charge to his people being holy. You can make your own notes as you work through this. Go to Leviticus 19. This is in what is called the Holiness Code. Leviticus 19, let's go verse 33. Here is, remember when I said that Friedman said not only did the Exodus it created some meaningful, how do you put it, some meaningful rules and stipulations and laws that came along later. Listen to this. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. The stranger who sojourns with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. Mm-hmm. This is a great idea. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am Jehovah your God. You shall not do wrong in judgment in measures of length or weight or quantity. You shall have just balances, just weights, and a just ephah, and a just hin. I am Jehovah your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and you shall observe all my statutes and all my ordinances and do them. I am Jehovah. In Deuteronomy 6, I'm not going to read it, there's this passage that says, when your son asks you, what is it with all these statutes and judgments? You know what the answer is? You were slaves and God saved you. Therefore, you'll do these and there'll be righteousness to you. Deuteronomy 6:25. If you keep them. The idea is that everything hinges on this event. Look at Leviticus 25, please. 25:38, and I'm not reading all of them. I'm just a few of them I have marked. And I am Jehovah your God, Leviticus 25:38. I am Jehovah your God who brought you forth out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan, and to be your God. He's making a name for himself. Look down at verse 42. For they are my servants. Notice, they are my servants, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. One of the great ideas that comes out of the Exodus story is that slavery to another human is not legal. Slavery to God is expected. See? It's like you can't belong to somebody else because you're Jehovah's servant. And that's why it's important when we criticize others, they're not your servants. You're criticizing Jehovah's servants, people who have a heart after God. That's why I started with take a deep breath, relax. All right, now go with me. Just flip over to 26:13, Leviticus 26:13. I am Jehovah your God who brought you forth out of the land of Egypt that you should not be their servants. And I have broken the bars of your yoke and made you walk upright. It's hard to wear a yoke when you're standing up straight. I think that's similar to a quote from Martin Luther King Jr., right? Stand up. Stand up straight. All right. Chapter 26, verse 44. Yet for all that, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not spurn them, neither will I abhor them, so as to destroy them utterly and break my covenant with them, for I am Jehovah their God. But I will for their sake remember the covenant with their forefathers, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am Jehovah. Pretty clear, right? I've got a few more. Numbers 15. Now, you remember in Numbers 15, verse 37 through 41, it deals with the tassels, the fringes, the tzitzit that we wear. So it tells the reason for that in chapter 15, verse 37 through 41. But just look at 41. I am Jehovah your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am Jehovah your God. Point clear? Point's clear. Now, a couple of passages from the prophets, just to pick them up. I always love Jeremiah, so let's read one from Jeremiah. Jeremiah 34, notice I'm skipping right over that new covenant, going to 34:13. Thus says Jehovah, the God of Israel, I made a covenant with your fathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. All right. Now go with me to Hosea. Hosea. Chapter 12, verse 9. I am Jehovah your God from the land of Egypt. I love that. I love the way that's worded. It's like, hello, I'm the God Jehovah from Egypt. It's like you'd call somebody on the phone. You'd go, hey, I'm Ross from United Israel. Oh, yeah, hey, Ross, how are you? Because they know that association. So here it's like, I am the Lord your God from the land of Egypt, and I will again make you dwell in tents as in the days of the appointed feast. Now look down at chapter 13, verse 4. He says it again. I am Jehovah your God from the land of Egypt. You know no God but me, and beside me there is no Savior. Amos. Go to Amos chapter 2. Amos chapter 2 and verse 10. Amos 2:10. Also, I brought you up out of the land of Egypt and led you 40 years in the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. Go down to chapter 3, verse 1. Hear this word that Jehovah has spoken against you, O people of Israel, against the whole family of Israel, which I brought up out of the land of Egypt. You only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. Everything in the Bible is tied to the event of the Exodus. They refer back to it. It is a constant reminder to the people. And it is so important to get the reason why. One more verse, Micah 6:4. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt, redeemed you from the house of bondage, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. These texts are to make the point that throughout history, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is associated with the exodus from the land of Egypt. Jehovah is known as the God, and he says this in his own language, is why I went through all that. I'm the one that redeemed you from the house, from Egypt, from the house of bondage. Don't have any other gods before me. Why? Because I'm the one that redeemed. You're my servants. You belong to me. You can't serve somebody else. Jehovah brought Israel out of Egypt, saved them from slavery to serve him and him alone. Over and over in the Exodus story, God tells Moses, go tell Pharaoh, shalak et ami, shalak et ami, shalak et ami. Let my people go. In Exodus 4, 22 and 23, he tells Moses, he said, you tell Pharaoh to let my son go. If he doesn't let my son go, I'll kill his firstborn. And Moses never tells Pharaoh that. Not according to the story. That's what God tells him to tell him. You let my son go, or I'm going to kill his firstborn. Pretty powerful. There are two texts in Deuteronomy that I want to touch on briefly as I wind things down. In Deuteronomy, there are two texts associated with serving God, with serving Jehovah, that add one detail. Deuteronomy 6, and I want to read to you verse 13, talking about Jehovah. Deuteronomy 6, 13. I'm not talking about a Messiah. We're talking about the God who will be the God of any Messiah, past, present, or future. Deuteronomy 6, 13. You shall fear Jehovah your God. You shall serve him, and you shall swear by his name. Deuteronomy 10, 20. Says the same. You shall fear Jehovah your God. You shall serve him and cleave to him. And by his name you shall swear. Now I posted an article on this on our United Israel site. I think it's very important. It's very important because as I'm making the point today, the whole reason that God redeemed Israel was to make for himself a name so that his name might be known throughout all the earth. Not this name is so great, so powerful. There is no other name. None other. Isaiah 45 says that it's to this name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in the Hebrew, that every knee will bow. Not another. And this is very important, that in serving God, and even swearing in that name is a law. So I've written this article that explains it, but I want to hit a couple of high points. The reason the one who rescued Israel from Egypt is the name whereby we are to swear, oath, it's because, as the Hebrew puts it, Hu Ha Elohim, because he is the Elohim. And there is no other. And it was this event, this watershed event, this exodus from Egypt that got him his name. Now, how, the question becomes, how does one swear using the name? I'm going to give you a couple of quick examples because this is something that's commanded. You shall swear on the name. Go with me to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel, in fact, I'll just read a couple of examples from 1 Samuel. You ever want to get the true biblical feeling? Read 1 and 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel 19, verse 6. And Saul hearkened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore. Now watch how he swears. As Jehovah lives, he shall not be put to death. This is called swearing in the name of Jehovah. Now, you don't want to do this and not be telling the truth, right? But notice, he makes this statement, as Jehovah lives. Jehovah Chai is the way it is in Hebrew. Look at 1 Samuel 20, verse 3. David replied, your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he thinks, let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as Jehovah lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. He's making a declaration, an oath, and it's accompanied with the word, as Jehovah lives. It's so certain. You see that? Now, look at 1 Samuel 28, verse 10. One more example. Saul swore to her by Jehovah. Here's a real clear example. As Jehovah lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. You see that? Very clear. He swears by Jehovah, and this is how he does it. Now, look at, let me say it this way. Despite the command to do, and examples of how to do it, no one does this. We don't swear by the name. Go with me to Jeremiah 4, because it is coming back. It has to. Jeremiah 4 says the following. If you return, O Israel, says Jehovah, to me you should return. See, I think Israel is beginning to return to Jehovah. See, I think in times past they returned to another, or they returned to others. But he's saying very clearly, if you return, return to me. If you remove your abominations from my face and don't waver, and if you swear as Jehovah lives, in truth, in justice, and in uprightness, then nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall they glory. You know what the promise to the patriarchs is? Is that through this people, all nations will be blessed. Do you realize that that will not happen until people return, till Israel returns to Jehovah, and until they swear as Jehovah lives? Read it. It says, then, if you swear, then this restoration will take place. Now, the context is on return. If you return, shuv, teshuvah. I want you to go to Jeremiah 16. Jeremiah 16, verse 14. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, says Jehovah, when it will no longer be said, as Jehovah lives, who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. Now, how many texts did I read today? And I didn't read them all. How many texts did I read that said, I am Jehovah who brought you out of the land of Egypt. I am Jehovah who brought you out of the land. I am Jehovah, the, you know, over and over and over and over and over and over. I did that for a reason. There are days coming when it will no longer be said, as Jehovah lives, who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. But as Jehovah lives, who brought up the people of Israel out of the north country and out of all the countries where he had driven them. For I will bring them back to their own land, which I gave to their fathers. This event is going to change everything. Like, literally everything. Look at chapter 23 of Jeremiah. Chapter 23, verse 7, therefore, behold, the days are coming, says Jehovah, when men shall no longer say, boy, if I had a nice soft pencil, I'd underline that. As Jehovah lives, who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as Jehovah lives, who brought up and led the descendants of the house of Israel out of the north country and out of all the countries where he had driven them, then they shall dwell in their own land. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what this event is going to be so incredible that if you think about it, history will be so paled that you won't even mention it. Now, if you don't mention about the Lord bringing the children out of the land of Egypt, I'm thinking of all kind of things. You know how the Ten Commandments start? I am Jehovah your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of... Now, how is that going to go? Does this call for a radical change one day, perhaps, of even the Torah? Oh, I've got plenty of examples. How much of the Torah, our present Torah, speaks about the Ark of the Covenant? Jeremiah says, look, days are coming when that will no longer be mentioned. They won't make another one. You won't be able to find it. You won't look for it. You won't even care about the Ark of the Covenant. Well, what do you do in Exodus where it talks about, and you shall construct an ark, make this box, cover it with gold, put rings on it, cover them with gold, put poles in it, cover it with gold, put two cherubim on it. You're not even going to talk about that. So what are we going to do when we get to Torah reading Terumah in the Olam Haba, in the world to come? Well, you're going to have, don't mention that, Jeremiah said. This is describing something that is so incredible. You see, God set out to make a name for himself. You know how he did it? He redeemed a people from Egypt, from a nation stronger and mightier than they. And in the process of making a name for himself, he redeemed a people. Now, there's coming an exodus that's even greater. And I've taught on this before, but not like I'm going to do next week. Because this great event, as great as it is, that we memorialize every year at this time of year, we eat our unleavened bread and our bitter herbs and whatever else you put on your plate. We tell the story. But one day, people won't even mention that story. Next week, I intend to talk about this other exodus that's coming and what the prophets say about it. And I encourage you to join us then. So until then, Shabbat Shalom and Chag Pesach Sameach. Have a joyous Chag festival. Shabbat Shalom.